Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald and Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking about civil actions arising out of things that happen in schools, specifically activities of teachers as to how they relate with their students. To help us understand all of this, we have my colleague at Joseph Greenwald and Lake, Sam Morse. Sam is in the civil litigation department at JGL, and prior to joining us, clerked on the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. He specializes and focuses his practice in all areas of civil litigation, primarily from the plaintiff side. Sam, welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, we're excited to talk about this. And before we get into the school environment specifically, tell folks first, when we talk about negligence in the legal concept of negligence, what does that mean?
So negligence, this is the first year of law school. Everyone takes torts. And what they teach you is there's generally four elements of negligence. There's duty, breach, causation, and damages. So in order to have a civil claim for negligence, someone has to breach a duty they owe to you. Most often, the duty someone owes to you that I owe to anyone walking down the street is reasonable care. So I can't leave ice on my sidewalk. If I do and someone falls, that's negligent because I have a duty to remove that ice to protect members of the public. So when we think about negligence, the four elements, duty, breach, causation, damages, there has to be a connection between what I did or didn't do and the damage that was caused. So that's kind of the broad outline of what negligence is. And if any of those elements are missing, there was no duty, there was no breach, there was no causation, and there are no damages, then you don't have a claim for negligence. All four elements have to.
So if I slip on the ice in your front yard, that you should have gotten rid of one way or the other, and I break my leg, that's a damage and injury that I sustained as a result of your negligence in that circumstance.
Exactly. Yeah.
If I fall and don't hurt myself, I'm perfectly fine. Then there's no damage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because you haven't been, I mean, unless you are out of work for a couple of days and you sustain some financial damage, then that would suffice for damages. So damages are usually the easiest part to prove because no one's going to contact a lawyer. No one's going to bring a suit if they have nothing to show about how they were harmed in any way.
All right. So now let's take this negligence concept and apply it to an academic, a school environment. Tell us a little bit about how what you're seeing relative to negligent actions against either teachers or administrators brought by students, the basis of those actions, and what they're being brought for.
So when parents send their kids to public school, there's this assumption that their kids are going to be taken care of. And there's this entire doctrine that when parents do send their kids to school, the teachers, the administrators, the principal, they're really taking the place of the parents. They're watching over the kids. They're making sure that they stay safe, that they don't get hurt. So there's this baseline expectation of how your kids are supposed to be taken care of while they're at school. But I mean, kids being kids and the world being the world, accidents happen, people are injured. And the question is really, when are teachers and administrators liable for those injuries that are suffered by students at school?
Walk us through some specifics, some particular potential incidents, and whether in those instances, how and if a teacher could be held responsible for a child's injury in school.
So I want to start talking about this by going over the law that's out there about when teachers are liable for negligence. There was a case in Montgomery County in the 80s called Hunter versus Board of Education, where parents brought a suit for educational malpractice. They basically alleged that the school had negligently placed their child in second grade, but caused him to be only learning first grade materials. And because of this, the child developed all these learning deficiencies, felt embarrassed, and suffered what the complaint said was a depletion of ego strength. So the
let's make sure I understand. So this is a kid who's 8 years old, roughly, right?
Yes.
And he's moved to second grade. And the parents, as a result of that move, believe that there was some sort of professional negligence. When you say malpractice, professional negligence on behalf of the school, right?
Yeah. So they negligently evaluated him and placed him in second grade when he should have been in third grade or first grade or something.
Okay.
Like that.
Okay.
Yeah. And so this went all the way up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said, absolutely not. This is a case where the negligence being alleged is educational malpractice. So we're not going to hold teachers liable. We're not going to hold schools liable where a kid is placed in the wrong class or he's not given a educational tool that the parents think he needs. So that's the line the Court of Appeals drew, that educational malpractice isn't actionable. But this really related to the educational process, so the academic process. It didn't relate to things that happen on the playground or in the hallway. There had to be some tightly related nexus to the educational process.
How old is this case, Sam?
So this case is old. This was in 1982.
All right. So this predates what we now know are called, at least here locally, IEPs or 504 type plans, independent educational plans, right? I mean, this was before that whole process began. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And okay. So when schools don't follow those, they're separate causes of action.
Okay.
But this is before IEPs, before 504s, I believe. But it was a narrow decision. It basically said there's no negligence suit when there's asserted errors in the educational process. We're going to defer to schools. It's not the judiciary's place to intervene and second guess the judgment calls that teachers and administrators make.
And in that case, I don't know if you recall, but had the parents complained at all or raised any concerns that their son or daughter was being moved in a direction that he or she shouldn't have been?
So I think in that case, the court actually said that there's an administrative process for this. You can go through the school system and challenge the decisions there, but the courts aren't going to get involved because there is this administrative process. One thing they did leave open in this Hunter case was that if a child was denied if they were placed in second grade instead of first grade, and there was some evidence of the fact that that was intentional or that was malicious, they were doing this to harm the kid or to piss off the parents, that would be actionable because that would really kind of be an intentional tort, which is different from negligence.
Okay. It was a purpose. That would be a purposeful act to try to harm this child and potentially harm his or her parents is what you're saying.
Exactly. And and the harm in this case, we're talking about, remember, those four elements of negligence.
Yep.
The harm wasn't financial. It was psychic harm.
Emotional, right? I mean, it's emotional.
It was emotional harm. Yeah. Yeah. So that suffices for the harm element.
Okay. We can get into how that's proven later on or at another time. But okay. So we move past this educational malpractice issue that at least in Maryland isn't a cause of action. I presume that's still the law here in Maryland. Is that right?
Yeah, that's still the law here in Maryland. And it's actually gotten a lot broader than that. So, right now, it's a lot harder for parents and children bringing actions against school boards to succeed in these cases because the scope of educational malpractice has been broadened so much that it's become where any tort, any injury that happens in the school can kind of fit into this educational malpractice tort. Into this limit on educational malpractice, even where there's really no tie to the academic process.
Okay. So the schools have been successful in precluding a lot of these actions by calling them educational malpractice, even in some situations where it could be argued that it's something else, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And the most often something else is failure to supervise.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. Let's move to that. So talk a little bit about that and what that means.
Yeah, so a teacher, a babysitter, a camp counselor, these people all watch kids and all have a special relationship with the kid they're watching that creates that duty to supervise. You have to be watching them at all times because that is what you are being paid to do. That is what you've been hired to do. And so in a case that also went up to the Maryland Court of Appeals in 1969 called Seigerman versus Jones, the Court of Appeals said, yes, you can hold teachers liable for failure to supervise, but only if it's foreseeable that in the absence of supervision, something bad would have happened.
Like, so, give us that for instance.
Yeah. So for instance, if I'm a teacher, I know that Jimmy is going to punch Johnny in the face the second I leave the classroom. I can't leave the classroom. If I have to go make copies or go do something, I have to have someone come to the classroom in order to make sure that there's supervision. Because I know that there will be something bad happening in the absence of my supervision.
All right. So let me just make sure I got this straight. So in instance one,
yeah,
in theory, in instance one, Jimmy's been beating on Johnny for the last month. I mean, this is, everybody knows that these two don't get along. They fight outside, they fight in the classroom, they fight everywhere. I'm teacher Bullet. I know I can't leave these two folks alone, these two kids alone. And if I do, based on what's going on, if I do, and then Johnny gets a concussion or gets badly injured as a result of Jimmy beating on him again, I knew or should have known that that was going to happen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that would have been negligent on my behalf.
Yeah, because it was completely foreseeable that this would have happened. And let's juxtapose that against, let's say Jimmy and Johnny have never gotten in a fight before. Teacher leaves the classroom. Jimmy bumps into Johnny. Johnny turns around, punches him in the face. That wasn't foreseeable.
Right.
I mean, kids, specifically kids, I mean, adults, not so much, because we're hopefully a little bit more mature than that. Kids kind of have a more of a chance to fly off the handle and get angry. And we're not going to hold teachers and schools liable when that happens.
All right. Tell us, how if at all, does this apply to, you know, like when kids bring weapons into school?
So there haven't been many cases that I'm familiar with where that's the basis of a negligence suit. But it would be easy to imagine if there were clear signs, if the teacher knew that Jimmy is talking about bringing knives, bringing mm-hmm. other weapons into mm-hmm. school, and this is documented, there's incident reports that show that they had this knowledge, and the student goes and brings a weapon to school, that could very well satisfy the foreseeability element needed for a negligence suit.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a little bit, it's difficult to see schools arguing that that would be educational malpractice.
Right.
But of course, there's an entire universe of conceivable arguments out there.
Okay. So toggling back to this negligent supervision, mm-hmm. if I'm a teacher and I'm listening to this, whether it's here in Maryland or elsewhere, mm-hmm. what do I need to be careful of, or what do I need to keep my eyes open for so that I can avoid these potential claims?
I think the important thing that teachers have to do, and my wife was a teacher, so we've talked about this a lot, and she's kind of shared with me the realities of being in a classroom.
Sure. Yeah.
All of tort law comes down to reasonableness. Mm-hmm. What is the reasonable thing to do? So number one, it's not leaving kids alone who you know and have knowledge are bullying each other or have gotten in fights before, because that could very well suffice for a failure to supervise suit. But it's also important to remember that teachers have to, they're normal people. They have to exit the classroom, go to the bathroom, make copies, go to the principal's office. There do have to be limits, but the limit, a common sense limit, is foreseeable. You don't leave the classroom. You don't fail to supervise when it's foreseeable that your absence from the classroom is likely to lead to a student's injury.
How much is a teacher really supposed to know? And by that, I mean, let's assume for the purposes of discussion that, you know, I'm a sixth grade teacher in a local middle school. And one of the students in my class has some significant mental illness that I don't, no one ever told me about. Although there might be some references in his or her file because it was a transfer from a special needs school or whatever the case may be. And, you know, and I'm teaching my kids and I'm getting ready to walk them all down the hallway. We're going to go do X or Y in the cafeteria or the multipurpose room or whatever. I stand out front. The kids start to come out. And at the back of the line, this kid starts to harm another child in school. What am I supposed to know in that circumstance? And at the end of the day, you know, and I'm playing devil's advocate with you a little bit. I mean, I'm here to teach. I'm not here to be a prison monitor.
Yeah. So I think what the law should do and what teachers should be aware of is that they're not being asked to kind of see 360 degrees around their heads at all times, because there's things happening behind them that by virtue of the direction that human eyes face, they can't see. So the only thing that teachers really need to do is be on the lookout for signs that the student at the back of the line is liable to harm someone in the absence of supervision. So like this old case, the Siegerman case, the Court of Appeals said it wasn't foreseeable because the teacher left the classroom while the kids were doing some push-ups or calisthenics. One of the boys moved from his spot to another spot, got in the push-up position, and ended up kicking a girl in the face, the girl who was behind him. And so this is not the sort of case where a teacher will be liable, because there was no evidence that this was foreseeable. This was an accident. And accidents are going to happen all of the time. And most of the time, there's not going to be any suit. There's not going to be no negligence, because it's a pure accident, and kids have accidents and do things.
No kidding. I raised four of them. There was plenty of them in my house. But so let me go back to my example for a second.
Yeah.
Teacher Bullitt, I don't know anything about this child who's had emotional behavioral issues before he transferred to my class, but my boss, the principal, did. He knows, because he's got his file, and in the file says he came, you know, here in Montgomery County, say from RICA, you know, from a higher level special needs type school. Mm-hmm. And I'm shortening that definition, obviously. When Principal Morse looked at the kid's file when he transferred, saw that he had beaten up three kids previously. Now, I put in his file. I put the kid into Teacher Bullitt's sixth grade class. I don't say anything to him. And sure enough, the minute Teacher Bullitt is walking down the hallway taking the other kids, this kid yanks a kid out of the line and pummels him. Mm-hmm. Is there any cause of action for the child and his family in that, who's hurt in that instance, even if whether it's the teacher or the administrator or the school system or whomever?
So, yeah. So in these cases, it's important to remember that the suits are going to maybe name the individual teachers, but it's the school system that's going to be liable. There's laws that in the Courts and Judicial Proceedings section of the Maryland Code that say up to a certain amount, and if there's no malice or ill will or intentional torts, the school system is going to pay any judgment.
If we go back to the negligence thought, right?
Yeah.
You're the principal. And weren't you negligent potentially in that circumstance? You knew or should have known about this kid's propensity that he hurts other children in class or in the school, and you didn't let the teachers know. So isn't that a theory that the parents might explore in that type incident?
I think that is a viable theory, because, I mean, you could meet all the elements of negligence. There's a duty to take reasonable care to make sure that all the students in the school are safe. The Principal Morse, has breached that duty by either failing to really look at the kids' records or reading the kids' records, but not telling the teacher, the substitute teacher, hey, watch out for Jimmy. Right. Keep an eye on him, because he's gotten in several incidents at his other school. And then again, the proximate cause and the harm, which are easy to show there if there's an injury. So yeah, it is a viable theory. And that's why it's important for administrators to really cover their bases and inform people who need to know of all the relevant information, because this will show that they didn't breach a duty. And even if a child is harmed afterwards, they'll be able to show, hey, I didn't breach this duty. I talked to the teacher. We went over the files. Things are still going to happen.
Right. Okay. So are there any federal laws or statutes that school systems can take advantage of in defending these types of claims?
So there is a law passed in, I believe, 2003, called the Paul D. Coverdell Teacher Liability Protection Act. And what this says is if teachers individually, not the school system, if teachers are individually liable, they're not going to pay damages. This is to protect individual teachers from liability because, I mean, teacher salaries are unbelievably low as it is. We're not going to expect teachers to pay $100,000 judgment. So school systems are taking advantage of this Coverdell Act defense to say the individual teachers aren't liable, but the Coverdell Act only protects individuals. It does not protect school boards and the Montgomery County Public Schools, Charles County Public Schools, they can't take advantage of the Coverdell Act.
In theory, I guess, the teacher is the agent of the school in that circumstance, right?
Yeah. They are responsible for taking care of the students, making sure nothing happens. But I mean, the important caveat is if there's an intentional tort, a teacher smacks a kid across the face, there's no protection for that. And I don't know, there was recently in the news, a teacher in Texas who took a kid out into the hall, slapped him across the face and pushed him against the wall. That's the sort of thing that is absolutely inappropriate and should not be covered under these protections for teachers.
That was in that case, it's an intentional act. It's an intentional act.
Yeah.
But for those folks out there who didn't take this in law school, right? Principals, i.e. employers, can be held responsible for the negligent acts of their agents, servants, or employees, in this case, the teachers. So if there was a negligent act by a teacher, while that teacher can't individually be held responsible, the principal, i.e. not principal Morse, I'm not dumping this money on your shoulder, of course, the principal, meaning the employer, could be, or in this case the school board, could be held responsible for the negligence of the teacher. In other words, have to pay whatever those damages may be.
Yeah. And I believe the law in Maryland right now caps it at $400,000.
Okay.
One of the other things I wanted to mention was that, so taking a kid out into the hallway and hitting them, this is kind of like a form of corporal punishment, which used to be okay in schools, but now
I remember that very well. Actually, yeah, I was a victim of corporal punishment on several occasions in elementary school.
I mean, yeah, thankfully I wasn't.
Yeah,
but yeah, so it was okay back then. And this whole regime around deference to schools, it kind of came of age in this time when corporal punishment was tolerated, like the proverbial example of getting flayed with like a ruler on your knuckles or something like that.
We had a teacher, Sam, when I was in fifth grade. Remember, you know, you're a kid in school and you would lean back in your chair, you know, from your desk, sort of tip in the chair. And a lot of kids would try to balance to see if they could stay without falling or moving forward. This guy would come behind the kids' chairs and yank them down, literally, and they'd flop onto the floor and bang their heads. And some cases, one kid, I remember getting cut with his pencil, and he said, just go to the bathroom and take care. You know, of course, I'm showing my age a little bit. That's 1970s, but that's not something you're going to see or you should see anymore in schools, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, let's use that example. If this kid coming up behind you is doing this all the time.
Oh, the teacher did it.
Oh, the teacher would do this. Okay. So this kind of blows the hypothetical out of the water.
But yeah, let's call it a kid. So go ahead. I wrecked your example. Go ahead.
No. Yeah. So if a kid was doing that and the teacher knows this, that he's going up to David's chair and making him fall every day, he leaves the classroom. He should know that he's going to do it again. And if David gets injured, I might be liable.
Okay.
But there's been kind of a development in this area where discipline, what counts as discipline, has kind of been enlarged. So there was two cases last year in the Court of Special Appeals. One was Gambrill, and that is currently pending at the Court of Appeals. It was a case where the parents alleged that their daughter was injured because the bully at the school wasn't properly punished. So it was a question of exclusionary punishment versus restorative punishment. And this, the Court of Special Appeals said, this was an educational decision because discipline is an inherent and an essential part of the educational process.
Sure.
So Court of Special Appeals said, if it's related to discipline and these kind of judgments that teachers have to make, then we're not going to hold them liable to that you should have expelled a kid instead of sending them to the office for a talk. Mm-hmm. So that sort of stuff isn't actionable. And that's part of the educational process.
I mean, discipline takes many forms, right? So I assume that if the discipline is looked at as, I hate to use the word reasonable, but let's use it in italics, you know, Mary's causing a lot of trouble in class. So I'm moving Mary out of her study group and she's going to go work by herself versus, which certainly is part of the educational process, but, you know, making Mary stand on one foot on her chair for the 45 minutes while everybody else does their work might be taking it a little bit too far.
Yeah, I think that would be a good example of taking it too far.
And that used to happen in schools. I mean, that used to happen. Again, I hate to show my age, but that used to happen in Montgomery County schools. I saw it happen. You know, teachers would make kids, would embarrass them, and embarrassing them was part of the disciplinary process, I guess, in those days, right?
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, and again, it comes down to what is reasonable.
Yeah.
There are going to be reasonable punishments and patently unreasonable punishments. I mean, let's use the example of a extremely violent kid again. Yeah. If there is an extremely violent kid, and instead of expelling him or suspending him, we just have him sit in. I mean, they're like, it sounds a little bit reductive, but circle talk, where you come together and you talk about the problems. Maybe in that instance, it wouldn't be enough because this kid is so clearly violent.
Right.
That we're not going to solve this through kind of the restorative methods that are really kind of at the forefront and restorative practices is the direction that schools are moving in now about how to address student behaviors.
I gotcha. It all depends upon the prism that you're looking through at any particular time. What could be reasonable today may not be reasonable tomorrow. And certainly what was reasonable 30 or 40 years ago may be looked at as not something that is appropriate now.
Exactly. And there's been this other development. So we've talked about failure to supervise. We've talked about educational malpractice. There was an unreported decision last year. In a case called Hodge in the Court of Special Appeals, where the court wrote this opinion and said basically the teacher had to do a little bit more, that the teacher was an idle bystander and liability could be premised on that. And in this case, if I recall the facts correctly, a student had a tantrum in the classroom and started to throw chairs. Mm-hmm. So the teacher calmly took all the students out of the classroom. Mm-hmm. And while they were filing out of the classroom, a chair bounced off the floor and hit a student in the back. Mm-hmm. And the question was, well, should the teacher have done more? And so I personally believe the answer is no. That teacher did the reasonable thing. They took the kids out of the classroom and an accident happened. I don't think that teachers shouldn't be required to put their selves at risk. They're not required to act as a human shield for the rest of their students. If they want to, sure, have at it. But by no means is the law going to require them to put themselves in harm's way in order to not be liable.
So in that case, the court found that the teacher's inaction, that the fact that that teacher didn't do anything, or at least didn't act, could be actionable. Here I go by mixing up legal parlance with day-to-day words, but could provide the basis for a lawsuit.
Yeah. And basically it said the teacher didn't do enough. And it's really hard to kind of draw that line because whenever someone gets injured, you can always say that they didn't do enough. They should have tied their shoes tighter. They should have looked 10 feet ahead of them instead of 5 feet ahead of them. So the idle bystander line, I think, is a really hard line to draw because in this case, I mean, you had facts that showed the teacher was doing something. They were taking the kids out of the classroom and a kid was hit by a chair while walking out of the classroom. So it's a really, I mean, I don't think that the idle bystander theory is going to really have a lot of weight in the future because it's so hard to say. I mean, if someone acts, they weren't idle. You have to be really, really sitting and not doing anything.
It's one thing, go back to our Jimmy and Johnny story. You know, if Teacher Bullet just sits behind his desk, puts his feet up and lets Jimmy pound Johnny into submission, I'm not doing anything. That to me is negligent. I mean, right?
Yeah.
Right. But in this other instance that you talked about in this Hodge case, this teacher was doing something. You know, she was acting in some fashion. Now, you know, they say hindsight is 20/20, and I guess this gets to the merits of all these cases. And medical malpractice cases, you always hear the term the retrospectoscope, right? You know, so if you could look at this injury now, but under what was going on then, you might have a different, might have done something differently. It's the same kind of idea. I mean, it seems to me is that you're, it's easy to say what someone should have done, but unless it's pretty obvious to most of us as parents or as individuals, it seems like that would be a difficult bar for somebody to get over if they're a plaintiff in that type of a case.
Yeah. Yeah. And the important thing for teachers to remember is if you think, if you're sitting in a situation and you think, I really am standing by idly right now while something horrible happens and I'm not doing anything about it, then the reasonable person in that situation would probably do something about it, even if it's just telling the kids to calmly leave the classroom.
Right.
So something like that.
Okay.
But yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Sam, thank you very much for joining us. I think we could probably continue this conversation indefinitely. It's been great talking to you. We're really happy to have you at Joseph Greenwald and Lake. And if anybody wants to get a hold of you for this type of a case or any other type of civil matter, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can email me, smorse@jgllaw.com, and you can call the office. You'll get me real quickly. But also, if you want to get in touch with me, I'm on Twitter, and I'm very active on Twitter, @SamuelPMorse. So if you find me there, feel free to get in touch with me.
Excellent. All right. I want to thank everyone out there for listening. We hope that you join us for our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.